newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Oh.
This is The Media Project, a half hour of commentary and analysis, some days even some insight into media issues of the week. And we welcome you. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Hello, Rex.
Hello, hello. How wonderful to see you. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist and professor.
Thanks for having me.
Very good to see you in studio. And Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association, former editor of the Daily Gazette.
Thanks for having me as well.
Well, you know, we're all being had. This is good. We're just all very glad to be here.
Nice,
it's a good
nice.
Thing. And we have an opportunity to talk about media issues. You know, in recent days, we have gone through basically convulsions of huge stories coming out of the nation's capital. We have had the intersection of an attack on foreign soil by the United States government and at the same time the pending trial on impeachment of the President of the United States. How are we thinking that the press is doing in handling the intersection of these two big stories?
Well, if you're the teacher, you should call on people.
So, Dr. Shartok, how would you say coverage is going? Because here's the difficulty. You have two big stories that may well be related. There are those who believe that Donald Trump accused Barack Obama, as Obama was seeking re-election, saying, you know, he's going to start an attack on Iran. Just watch. And there are those who believe that that is at part in play in what the president did with respect to assassinating the foreign leader.
Well, there's no question that the impeachment took a back seat to the fact that we could all be incinerated, you know, in a nuclear war started by this president. I mentioned it to our distinguished panel here at WAMC, and it got some traction. I mean, I think it is more than possible that Trump knew what he was doing when he put this on the table. I must say, though, it's so interesting to be intuitive and to go to sleep at night and say, I wonder if I'll wake up, you know, in the morning. Being old has its advantages, and I do remember Khrushchev and JFK duking it out over Cuba. And one of the interesting things about that is much, much later, we found out what it was that the United States gave up to the Russians. The way that the press played it here was JFK was the big winner. But it turned out that Turkey and other things were in play during that time. So I didn't think that the press distinguished themselves at that point. And at this point, nobody knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the difficulty of reporting Washington in this war situation is a lot harder, too, than Cuba. At least some information, misleading as it was coming from the White House in those days. It painted this heroic picture of the White House. We're getting literally nothing now except the tweets, which are really interesting to watch. There are no press briefings. There have not been in nearly a year now. Even when the president's men went to Congress yesterday, what they did was, and the congressmen and the senators are complaining about it, Republicans are complaining about it, just said, don't debate this, don't argue it, you just go along with us, which is a completely different, it's so authoritarian. It's not PR spin anymore, it's just shut up and trust us that we'll do the right thing. Very different point of view.
You know, in many respects, I thought these were being handled as standalone stories early on. We had the impeachment stories, and then you had what was happening in Iraq and Iran in a separate lane. And I had to go to social media for Twitter, for example, to find the intersection. If you were an average reader or an average viewer, I think a lot of that was missing, and you really had to search to get the analysis pieces that would weave them together like you wanted to. That being said, I also thought the press has done a fairly good job of covering the fires in Australia, which I think are really important, so we don't get overwhelmed by our own wringing of our hands.
You know, that's one other difference, too, from Cuba and previous crises, is that we get now, the media, gets much more information from foreign reporters. So that, for example, we found out that Trump was meeting with the Saudi assistant defense guy from the Saudi media. I didn't know there was such a thing, but from Saudi reporters. And we're hearing a lot of what of his interactions with the Russians from the Russian media. We didn't used to do that. And then there is Twitter, which was extraordinary here. Trump has learned to bypass the press by using Twitter, and now he's bypassing diplomats. He told Congress, here's my warning, this tweet, that's to let you know 48 hours notice that I can do anything. On the other hand, he was talking directly through Twitter, this was fascinating, with the assistant defense minister of Iran. And the two of them were talking to each other. The press on the right, the sympathetic to Trump press, is saying this was a good thing they de-escalated. Hmm. One could say, no, I don't think we'll react. And the other said, we're only reacting proportionate to what you did. Take it easy here. So did we see a new form of diplomacy on Twitter?
It's interesting. And since we don't get, I mean, one of the points that you made was that we're in the absence of the official channels of communication, these other things are happening. Stephanie Grisham, the White House press secretary, has been so absent, you know, since she became press secretary months ago. She hasn't had a single press briefing. Anderson Cooper, on his program on CNN, did a scathing attack on her, pointed out that no Americans could differentiate her from any number of other people. Who can pick her out of? I don't know what she looks like. She looks like a Fox anchor, I presume.
She does.
And Anderson Cooper ended up by saying, yes, your taxpayer dollars are indeed paying Ms. Grisham to avoid you, ironically, like it's her job. So it is a remarkable thing that actually encourages journalists to dig deeper when they can't just sit back and rely on press briefings. You actually end up having to go out and find the other ways to get information. Yeah, I would think that, you know, not to attack the White House press corps, but if you have a lot of information coming at you from the White House official sources, you're going to be busy chasing that down, which is what reporters in the White House press room used to complain about. Now, since there isn't information coming at them, the administration really is yielding the field to let the journalists go out and get the stories on their own. It's sort of a counterproductive tactic. If you're the White House, you would think you'd be trying to fill their inboxes, digital inboxes, with information so that they wouldn't have time to go out and find it on their own.
But they do believe, the Trump people, that the press is the enemy of the people and certainly an enemy of them. I love watching CNN because I love to watch Manu Raju put the microphone in front of so many people's faces. Mm-hmm. And even when they ignore him and walk by him and basically, you know, are rude to him, you get the idea, oh, that guy was just rude to Manu Raju. And new heroes develop. Who would have thought that this guy was going to end up being an American icon just because he works so hard and he looks a little different from everybody else and he's just great?
You know, it's not just the executive branch that's shut down briefings. The Defense Department is also not having briefings like it used to, and that is creating a huge gap in the public's knowledge of what's happening with our military.
So do the Russians do briefings every day?
No, I guess that technically is Executive Department, too, in defense. Right. But you could have mentioned Congress. There was a great interview, great from a, like, do you believe this interview with Nancy Pelosi yesterday, where she's fast walking across the halls of Congress. Mm-hmm. The reporter's running next to her, you know, getting her reaction. And then she stops and delivers a blistering, you know, why are you asking that question? Are you listening to me? So the abuse they take, the conditions they're working under are very different now. This is not an administration anywhere that wants to talk to the media.
Yeah, it is. It has become very difficult, actually, to find what's really going on and to cover things. So I do actually admire the work that's being done there. One of the things that you find, actually, in regional news outlets, local news outlets like ours that we are dealing with, is the localization of these national stories, which sometimes you can kind of poke fun at. I remember when I was a reporter on Long Island, there was a fire at a resort in Puerto Rico, I believe, and we... The story that ran in my newspaper was something, fire in Puerto Rico, two Long Islanders killed.
At UPI, it was so crazy that you'd have a national story like a fire in California, and in Ohio, they'd be printing, there are no fires in Ohio.
Yeah.
What?
But I do remember one of those stories in Puerto Rico, which is why I laughed, is there was a fire and a very prominent politician jumped out the window.
Ah.
Yeah, and so do you remember that?
Yeah. We have a correspondent, the Times Union has a Washington correspondent that we share with the Hearst papers in Connecticut, and we will sometimes ask her, go ahead and write what the term would be, the lead all, the story that is going to be the main story on this particular issue, but get our local people up high. Get Congressman Paul Tonko or Antonio Delgado and Elise Stefanik up high.
She's made her job easy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she suddenly is emerging. And that, in a way, that skews the news a little bit because it gives added importance to local people that it wouldn't otherwise deserve. But, you know, proximity is a factor of newsworthiness. And so that's how we justify saying, you know, we're actually serving our readers this way. But sometimes you do worry that your local news focus takes away some of the impact of these huge national and foreign stories.
We would call it a main bar, where you have the main story, but you do try to localize it because the local people want to know how the representatives are voting on a particular issue, or they want to know whether somebody local is headed off to war, or whether the local unit of the Air National Guard is going to be involved. You always try to find those local connections, and you know it does bring the story home to localities in a way that just a general story out of Washington doesn't. The readers, however, do not appreciate the difference between something that a local newspaper runs from a wire service and what your reporters write. They think AP is in my office writing the same stories, and so we're held to the same level of accountability for what AP or the Washington Post or New York Times writes. So we have to read those stories, vet them, and make sure that they suit the needs of our readers, that they're not slanted one way or the other.
So if I can, I'd love to ask you, inside baseball guys, whether you negotiate with AP. In other words, when AP is going to do a story on something, do you say, I really don't know, do you say to them, hey, can you do it this, thus and so, or do they just do what they want?
Not anymore. I'd say that there was a time my predecessors had time to do that, and they had enough space in the paper to want to do that. Years before I came to the Times Union in the 90s, there was a managing editor who would call up wire services and harangue them and say, look, the Washington Post is reporting this. Can you get that into your story? And we don't run enough wire copy to justify that intrusion of time. We don't have enough time to do that.
It's also a matter of competition, Rex. When I was at UPI, and again, this was decades ago, and we were competing for clients, then the UPI and the AP would both listen to editors because they wanted your business. Oh, yeah. I'm responsive to you, so I get your contract.
Yeah, an interesting point.
Why did UPI die?
Well, competition. I mean,
no money. Newspapers are cutting back. Why do you need two wire services? They essentially cover the same thing. You don't need both. Bad management.
Yeah, and AP's a cooperative. It's owned by the newspapers. And UPI, I think, was privately held.
Yes.
And so a couple of bad decisions on debt, on borrowing, put it into a financial situation that it just couldn't.
But let there be no mistake. It's better to have two than to have one, isn't there?
Well, but there are so many sources for information nowadays. It's not just the AP is the way people get news. There are, of course, other wire services from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so on. But people get news on Twitter from God knows where.
The flip side, though, of localization that we've been talking about is there's an insensitivity to things that happen far away that is really obsolete now in the global age. So, for example, if there's an earthquake in Pakistan, we'll get a brief little story, and that's the end of it. Or even the plane crash in Iran, that probably will have some resonance here because of the American war with Iran. But there were no Americans on that plane. That would not get a lot of coverage normally.
But, you know, localization does have this salutary effect. If you look at the public service role of journalism, it helps to keep your readers connected to the story. And that is one of our goals. If you can connect people to the news, that really makes them more connected to their community. And that's, you know, one of our roles, actually.
I used to teach about this in reporting classes. There was one story about it, the discovery of this exceedingly rare skeleton of a prehistoric bird-like ancestor. And it was sweeping. The New York Times did it sweeping, and you know what this meant and what it looked like and how excited everybody was. And then the Kansas, I think it was Kansas paper, where the scientists were from, did two local guys made a big discovery, you know? And it was like, oh my, you lost all the sweep and grandeur of the story.
Yeah.
So it can be overdone.
Yep. Tell us what you think. media@wamc.org is how we hear from you, and you can share your thoughts on media issues of the week, media@wamc.org. Just an interesting little development while we're on sort of inside baseball. California has a new law that limits news outlets' ability to hire freelancers in an effort to somewhat restrict the gig economy, which a lot of people believe has been unfair to workers. The California legislature passed a bill last year that now has become law that limits the number of stories that a freelancer can file and be paid for and still be considered a freelancer. You go beyond 35 stories in a year, you have to be hired as a full-time staffer. And the result has been that some media outlets have just stopped using freelancers. And it is a problem, I think, in an ecosystem, an information ecosystem that increasingly relies upon freelancers. In my own newsroom, we use freelancers for most of our features coverage these days to write about food and the arts, not entirely, but a lot. And I worry about the New York legislature typically copies California and a lot of these things. I worry about that coming. The American Society of Journalists and Authors and the National Press Photographers Association have sued to block the California law. But I think about a lot of the aspiring journalists out there. That's who many of the freelancers are, people who either want to be freelancers as a career rather than having to work for one particular employer, or those who are doing this to get a toehold and then come into full-time jobs. I worry that they're going to lose their place. And it just seems like it is an ill-placed piece of legislation that could have an impact on the content that you're going to see in your news reports.
It's like tipping in the restaurant business. You know, it is not fair that customers pay for the salaries of servers. That should be an employer's thing. But making the change is going to result in loss of jobs, bad service, lots of bad things. The same thing, I think, will happen with freelancers. And we saw it happen with interns in the news business. Is it slavery to have someone work for no money, just academic credit? But the result has been no internships, no experience, none of that valuable time in a news outlet.
Yeah. You know, there's a long history of freelancers in our business. We used to call them stringers.
Right.
And that goes back decades and decades. But there has been an increasing reliance on freelancers. But a lot of the columnists are freelancers as well, and they want to write a column every week. That's 52. That's more than 35, which will really dent into their business. The life of a freelancer is difficult. They have to try to organize how to get paid. They don't have health insurance. So I can recognize that there's some effort to bring them into the fold, but the needs of a newspaper are so varied that the variety that a freelancer brings is something that will be hard to duplicate by a staffer.
Well, what do you mean when you say bring them into the fold?
Into the building.
Turn them into employees. The problem is if you have, like, the amount that in my newsroom I spend on 50 freelancers who provide content over the course of a year, you know, that could lead to probably two jobs in the newsroom. And those two people could not provide nearly as much coverage as those 50 people writing more occasionally for me do.
So who got to the California legislature that they would do this?
Labor unions.
Yeah, and it's not named specifically at newspapers. It's Uber and Lyft. It's all of these new freelancing jobs.
Contract hires.
Now, in the academy, right, Rosemary, we have such a thing, and we have adjuncts who, instead of having full-time people doing the teaching, we have people for much less money.
Yes.
And you had a full-time job at the university, right?
Yep.
And
then
tenured professor who somehow gave up the job.
Seemed so noble at the time. Had I known. And now I'll go back, and as an adjunct, I'll teach the same load at about, it's just hideously less. Hideously less than I made as a full professor. I don't have to go to faculty meetings, though, and so that may be worth it.
That's worth it right there.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. But that is a... Is that a survival technique for universities? I mean, why is that?
Yes.
Yes.
And I'm sure the newspapers will tell you, to some degree, it's a survival technique to have freelancers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that for a lot of small newspapers, especially, you know, very small papers, the freelancers are what they entirely depend upon for their news report. And there are various financial assaults. Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York, in his State of the State, sounds like he's going to take another swing at trying to force newspapers to turn carriers into staffers also. That was finally taken care of last year, or year before last, by legislation that said, no, newspaper carriers are not employees. That is another thing that could actually drive a lot of little newspapers out of business. You can't say that you can have a newspaper in print that can deliver its content to people if you're in Herkimer County, New York, for example, or
Diamonds.
Something like that. If you're what?
Diamonds, you say.
It's a reflex. Say Herkimer, he says.
Oh. I say diamonds.
Sorry.
Because once during a fun drive, there is a so-called diamond mine. It's a phony diamond mine. They look like diamonds. Mm-hmm. They gave us access for our people to come as a premium. And so from that moment on, and this has to be 20 years ago, every time the word Herkimer comes up, we all yell diamonds.
Well, it's like when people talk about Argyle, New York.
Socks.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just play the straight man here.
But having the carriers be considered employees is a huge financial responsibility for the newspapers, it's especially in the realm of workers' compensation, which is, you know, into the weeds a little bit, but it's something the newspapers do not want, and it will be an added financial liability for them.
And yet we listen to Rex, and he makes the point that print newspapers are an endangered species. And
but they're so, not dead yet.
No. No, that's right. But they are an endangered species, and we see that there are closings. And so the point really is as people stop reading the physical paper and go more and more to the electronic, the newspaper carriers are going to be less needed.
All of this is like it's the traditions and the history of journalism that led to carriers and stringers. And it all seems logical and reasonable to us. From the labor union's point of view, it is the same as Uber and Lyft. And I can appreciate their wanting to restructure everything. But like the restaurant owners, it requires total restructuring of your budget, your way of operating. And is that something we really want newspapers taking on now when we have all of this work to be done in the public trust covering issues? I'm very torn by the issue.
We've talked about how in these outlying communities in rural areas, a lot of news deserts emerge, a term that was particularly popularized in the academy by a professor in North Carolina, Penny Muse Abernathy. But these news deserts, it turns out, in terms of a new study done through Columbia University, through the Tau Center for Digital Journalism, finds that there are news deserts even in the media capital of the world, New York City. That while 12% of all the newsroom employees in the United States live in New York City, and there are all these journalists in New York, there are significant areas, both geographic areas and topical areas, in New York City that are not getting covered, which I think points to more of the threat that the digital revolution is imposing upon the news industry. It's a remarkable situation. This new study found that healthcare issues and courthouses are going underreported, even in New York City, that there needs to be better environment and climate change reporting. And even the not-for-profit newsrooms that thrive in New York City tend to have national focus. The major New York City news outlets, of course, focus on what to do enterprise reporting, that is, the bigger stories, rather than the day-to-day coverage of what's going on in communities. And so those communities simply don't get covered.
Yeah, I want to give kudos to the authors of this study because it captures the complexities of the news business in New York City or at any local level in a way I haven't seen before. They mentioned, for example, that even within geographic beats, many news outlets acknowledge that some neighborhoods get better coverage than others. In some cases, some such limitations are dictated by physical distance and others by where the subscription and advertising dollars are made. It is not as simple as just saying we need to cover, we want to cover. It's an issue of what do we cover, how do we cover, what audiences are we trying to reach, how do we fund it. And in every little neighborhood, it's different. And it's always been that way, but these issues are coming to the forefront, and this study did a great job of capturing it.
Well, thank you guys for clearing this up, because I always thought, I misread it, I always thought it was news desserts.
Just getting a little hungry there. It all comes back to that. We did have a letter from a reader. She saw a story on PBS NewsHour about Report for America, and she asks about that. It's a very interesting organization, Report for America. It is like, in a way, Teach for America, which we're familiar with, sort of like the Peace Corps for journalism, let's say. And I think that there are probably 5 dozen Report for America reporters out there, funded by not-for-profits, but they are put into actual newsrooms. These are not just in news deserts, but these are in cities, for example, where there are newspapers that have areas, as we were talking about here, that go unreported. So these young reporters, some of them just out of school, some with up to 5 years of experience, get a couple of years of pay, largely through this not-for-profit, some of it subsidized by the local newspapers, to be able to do the reporting that it would otherwise be undone because of the decline of the finances of the newspaper industry. Interesting.
It's underfunded. They need lots more of reporters. Of course, as newspapers continue to decline, there's more and more areas like that.
You know, and while it's commendable, it's a one-shot. And one-shots are just that. They're there now, but it's not a long-term solution to this, to our problems.
And these are generally not expert reporters, not the kind of experienced, know what to look for, know how to cover a story people.
On the other hand, Rex just talked about Teach for America. And an awful lot of people did that and really understood all about education and children and what to do. It's a very productive program.
Right.
Yeah. You get these bright young people in Teach for America who are energetic and have new ideas. And the same thing is going on. For example, I have a young reporter right now, last year graduated from George Washington University, who is one of the reporters covering New York State government for me down in the State Capitol Bureau, who's doing a terrific job. Sometimes the people who are new can bring some energy to it. Report for America has 60 reporters. Their goal is to have 250 this year in place and 1,000 in newsrooms by 2024.
That used to be the glory of newsrooms. You'd have young people coming in with energy and idealism and all the old-timers with their skepticism and experience. And, of course, the additional problem is the old-timers are all gone. They've been offloaded long ago. And now I go into newsrooms and they look like college campuses.
Of course, when you and I talk about old-timers, those are really old-timers, you
That's
know,
true.
Rosemary.
Yeah, they're not there. They're not around. I'm talking about people like me.
I mean, exactly. Oh, we're still here, folks. All right. We're out of time, I'm afraid, for this week's edition of The Media Project. Can I use that old-fashioned word? Edition, right? Dr. Alan Shartok of Northeast Public Radio, Rosemary R. Mayo, investigative journalist, Judy Patrick of the New York Press Association, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. With thanks to David Gustina, our producer, and thanks to you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people, when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.